Welcome to Forums for a Future. No, it's not 1960. It's nearly half a century later. But, once again, there are warnings of danger all over the land. It's time, once again, to reclaim a future that is free of war, racism, and poverty. A brighter future of promise and hope. I am Edward Renner, your host for a series of civic discussions, forums, if you will, toward creating a more viable future. The complete outline for the podcast series and all of the reference materials are available on the Forums for a Future homepage on my website at www.kerenner.com. It is not sufficient to complain about the present. One must also have a prescription for the future. Podcast number 6, The Postmodern Era. Part 1 of the series contained a brief 2-minute promotional and a conceptual foundation for thinking about change as the convergence of economic, political, social, and personal perspectives. Part 2 is a set of 4 podcasts that provides a philosophy for the 21st century. Today, in podcast number 6, I will discuss the key concept that we are now living in the postmodern era. As a start, just when did the modern era end and the postmodern era begin? The short answer is the year 2000 is a convenient reference point. What came before the modern era, and when did it start? The answer is the Age of Enlightenment and Discovery, starting in the 1400s. What accounts for the end of one era and the beginning of another? The answer is an inflection point that marks a change in core beliefs and values. Now, obviously, inflection points are not something that happen overnight, but most often emerge over time. But, as we discussed in the last podcast, change happens faster now than it used to. What took centuries in the past can now take only decades. Let's briefly review the history of human progress to illustrate how inflection points reflect a shift in core beliefs and values. Before the Age of Enlightenment and Discovery, the fate of humankind was largely controlled by nature and was seen as the will of God. Church and fate were the mechanisms of social control. Thus, the early explorers brought priests with them to the New World to save the souls of the natives. The church provided the justification of salvation for the conquests that followed. The inflection point for the beginning of the modern era was the emergence of science and technology, and the shift to a belief that nature could be controlled, and with it, the shift from the church to the state as the primary mechanism of social control. The first phase of the modern era, the 1800s, were characterized by the development of fundamental knowledge. This was the knowledge that transformed transportation, communication, agriculture, and manufacturing. The second phase of the modern era, the 1900s, were characterized by the refinement and development of the products of science and technology, which together promised to elevate the quality of life. They were to be the rainbow, at the end of which was a pot of gold for every person. The Great Society of the late 60s and early 70s was that brief moment of trying to reach this expressed purpose of the modern era. But alas, it was too late. By the year 2000, it was clear that the modern era had run its course. There was no pot of gold for everyone, as we now know. The inflection point for the start of the postmodern era is best captured by the terms global and economic. Democratic capitalism emerged as the political structure of destiny at the end of the modern era, not socialism, not communism, and not fascism. And now, global and economic forces are starting to replace the state and science, just as the state and science had replaced the church and fate as the primary mechanisms for civilization and social control in the past. Thus, today, just as at the past inflection points in history, we need new institutions based on new ways of thinking that refine how issues are conceptualized. Every inflection point requires enormous shifts in core beliefs and values for each of the pillars of the structure of this podcast, namely the economic, the political, the social, and the personal. Let us consider each of them in order as they apply to the postmodern era. First, the political, which is characterized by the escape from regulation. With globalization, capitalism has been able to escape the boundaries of effective regulation. In many ways, we face today the same issues that were faced in the late 1800s and the early 1900s. But now, we have moved beyond the capacity for their resolution through the mechanisms of national regulation that was available then. In the early stages of the Industrial Revolution, workers literally ended up owing their soul to the company store. In the United States, the government provided troops to support the effort by industry to stop unionization, all in the name of law and order. It took a major redefinition of our social beliefs and values to finally figure out that killing yourself working in order not to starve to death was not a human right, but rather a human wrong. The justification in the modern era was not service to God, but to nation building, as the state increasingly replaced the church as the structure for civilization and social control. It took until well after the New Deal and up to the Great Society for it to become unconstitutional and illegal to exploit workers, and for us to see the obligation of government to protect life, liberty, and equality of opportunity. However, all of that is rapidly slipping away. The new robber-barians of economic globalization are once again out of control. In the case of Enron, they were able to artificially create the California energy crisis in order to falsely inflate prices to gain personal and corporate profit. Exxon alone had $36 billion quarterly profit at the end of 2005. This time, the role of government, similar to the early modern era, has been to support globalization by deregulation and by free trade as the means to reduce the friction of doing business. The result has been a resurgence of corporate power to transfer greater and greater proportions of wealth from the poor to the rich. The new world economy is no longer accountable to any nation state. Increasingly, in the United States, corporate interests own the political process through campaign financing and own the minds of Americans through consolidation of the media. As Thomas Friedman notes in his book, I quote, "Companies have never had more freedom and less friction in the way of assigning research, low-end manufacturing, and high-end manufacturing anywhere in the world. what this will mean for the long-term relationship between the companies and the countries in which they are headquartered is simply unclear. Close quote. That's from page 209. Who let the dogs out? The robber barons are once again free for the personal accumulation of wealth at the expense of individual well-being. Now, in the postmodern era, the justification is not in the service of nation-building, but in the service of globalization and economics, which are increasingly replacing the state and knowledge as the structure for social control. Now, for the second pillar, the economic, which is characterized by the new tools of wealth. The new global economy has been made possible through digital technology that allowed design, manufacturing, and marketing to be disassembled and reassembled at any time or place without regard to international boundaries. This is not a quantitative refinement of old technology, like that which characterized the evolution of the modern era in the 1900s. Rather, it is a qualitative shift to a new foundation for the production and distribution of both goods and services. It owes no allegiance to any nation-state, and as a result, it knows no boundaries. As societies become more complex, specializations emerge in which there is a class system with the wealth accumulating at the top and the gut work with minimum compensation at the bottom. When the principal value is no longer in the product as it used to be, but in the process as it is becoming, then there is a significant shift in the economic engine of wealth. There are millions of dollars in profits and wages for those who own the stocks and who manage the markets, and pennies for those who do the actual work. Globalization is taking the divisions between those at the top and those at the bottom of social class to new levels of disparity. Increasingly, those who manage knowledge and information also manage and control the quality of life of the average person. Now, for the third pillar, the social, which is characterized by the limits of growth. The typical anti-globalization argument goes like this. When all goods and services are tradable, developed countries are headed for an absolute decline in their standard of living. This is due to new, cheap labor sources entering the global economy at much lower wages. As we globalize, for the average American worker, there is a race toward the bottom to be on a par with the lower wage standards of Mexico, India, and China. No, 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 is the pro-growth response. They claim the dip in the standard of living will not be permanent as long as the global pie keeps growing. Every time some jobs are lost to globalization, new jobs are created and more people have more income to spend. As a result, the economic pie grows larger. The pie grows larger because wants become needs, which are infinite. And with infinite wants and needs, there are infinite new businesses and new opportunities. This article of faith, advanced by Friedman in support of globalization, and I quote, is that the sweep of history clearly shows every time we had more trade, more communications, we had big upswings in economic activity and standard of living. Close quote. That's page 231. So, therein lies the basic anti-globalization, pre pro-globalization debate. But this debate misses the major point, big time, on three counts, as the lessons to be learned from history. The first count is sustainability. It is the lesson from history that is the sole theme of Diamond's book. Every major civilization that has collapsed has done so after going through a period of growth during which it outstrips the capacity to be sustained by its supporting geographic environment and its ecology. The people on Easter Island used the wood faster than it could be replaced, and in the end died because they would not change and because there was no place else to go. Our world society is currently on a similar non-sustainable course. As Jared Diamond notes, and I quote, "At current rates, we shall have depleted or destroyed most of the world's remaining marine fisheries, depleted clean or cheap or readily accessible reserves of oil and natural gas, and approached the photosynthetic ceiling within a few decades. Thus, because we are rapidly advancing along this non-sustainable course, the world's environmental problems will get resolved, one way or another, within the lifetime of the children and young adults alive today. The only question is whether they will become resolved in pleasant ways of our own choice, or in unpleasant ways not of our choice, such as warfare, genocide, starvation, disease epidemics, and the collapse of societies." End quote. That's on page 498. As a simple analogy, we need to be living off of the income of the earth, but rather, we are spending down its capital. But this time, when we go broke, there is no place else to go. The very inconvenient truth is that we are living beyond our means. In the United States, the average ecological footprint is 24 acres of biological productive land to sustain the consumption of each person. If everyone, through the continued growth, which is projected as the new pot of gold of globalization, lived at this standard, it would take nearly six planets to sustain life as we know it. And this figure does not take into account the additional load being placed on the planet from the rapidly accelerating increase in the world's population. Now, the second count on the lesson from history is the global economic delusion. Yes, at the end of the modern era, the average standard of living had indeed increased as the flood of new goods and services made their way to the marketplace. My grandfather, born in 1881, had no car, lights, refrigeration, telephone, radio, airplane, or TV when he was born. Yet, he had all of these before he died. But, relatively speaking, he was worse off. The disparity between the rich and the poor within our country increased, as did the disparity between our country and the poor countries of the world. We have enough wealth in our country that no child needs to go without food or health care. Yet, we do not provide these, while the pay for corporate executives and for the wealthy who are leading the charge toward globalization has reached billions of dollars per year. The suggestion there really is, finally, a pot of gold for everyone at the end of globalization is a dream. In reality, there is a non-sustainable rush toward increasing consumption to yield greater and greater profits for a few at the expense of the many. Now, the third count of the lessons from history is the biggest delusion of them all. It is the global political delusion described by Dyer in his book. It is the creation of the new American empire. It is the unapologetic aspiration of Bush and the neoconservatives now in charge in Washington to make the United States the only nation with sufficient military power to control all of the natural resources of the world that it wants or needs. And it is based on the conviction that globalization and free market capitalism, as the mechanism for achieving this, is good for everyone, even if the United States has to use military force to show the rest of the world what is right. The most dangerous part is the linking of this new American empire with the religious right, to lend the justification that globalization in the form of democratic, free market capitalism, based on infinite growth, is not only for the economic good, but is morally right, when in fact it is wrong on both counts. First, the planet is at the limits of growth. In the most immediate sense, the huge military expense of the war machinery of empire could have made the United States energy sufficient, largely through wind power and other technologies that already exist. Secondly, in the larger political sense, it places the United States on a course of attempting to secure, through force, energy resources that will trigger global resistance and global instability. The likely response is the need for even greater military power to confront the rise of anti-American hostility in the face of growing competing nationalism and a repetition of the history of global political conflict. This is the really big global delusion, and it is made possible by individual people yielding to the smaller delusion that measuring progress under globalization is based on making more and more money for a few, rather than being measured by the quality of life for the many, which is the ultimate standard of what is sustainable on this planet within the lifetime of the children and the youth alive today. So, there you have it, the reasons why the postmodern era is different from the modern era that preceded it, and, most important, why an examination of our core beliefs and values is essential. We have crossed an inflection point. This is the fourth pillar, the personal. We need to believe in a new American revolution, not an American empire. In the original American Revolution, the people overthrew the English King George, and the result was the invention of democracy, which got the world through the modern era. Now it is time for the new American Revolution, in which the citizens of the United States overthrow the self-appointed King George. The result can be the reinvention of a democratic process appropriate for the postmodern era. By definition, a democracy involves freedom of choice and cannot be exported through the barrel of a gun. To say goodbye, empire, is to say hello to a brighter tomorrow. Such choice points are times of opportunity. This is, in fact, one of the most exciting times in history to be alive. The choices we make will be either good or bad, depending on our willingness to acknowledge that this is a new era and to look to the future, not to the past, to find the way. Okay, in sum, Thomas Friedman's book explains the economic globalization that is taking place to define the modern era in terms of the impact of a frictionless, democratic, free market capitalism under the sword of the United States. Gwen Dyer, in his book, explains why that economic trajectory is political suicide for the world in terms of undermining the essential political stability required for living peacefully together in a flat world. And Jared Diamond, in his book, explains why that same economic trajectory, so clearly outlined by Thomas Friedman, is social suicide for the world in terms of undermining the environmental and societal foundation essential for the continuation of sustainable civilization on this planet. This is not a pessimistic outlook. There are solutions. We already know what needs to be done. We do have a future, but it must be claimed by us, and there is an urgent need to start the dialogue to do so now. I hope you will continue to stay with me on this journey. It is indeed an exciting time to be alive.
How many times must the
No, it is not 1960, and I am not living in the past. It's nearly one half of a century later, and I am looking into the future. There's an urgency now to finish what was started then. It has taken another war, another replay of Vietnam, to bring us full circle. But this time, there is the absolute necessity of putting into practice what was then seen as the exuberance of idealistic youth. Well, it's no longer youthful idealism. It is our new reality for both the youth and the adults of today. Either we embrace fundamental economic, political, social, and personal change, or we will forfeit our collective future. The youth and the adults of today have common cause for a cross-generational commitment, a commitment by the youth to lay claim to a viable future, a commitment by adults to revisit the idealism of their past, this time for actually creating a sustainable future. What an exciting time to be alive.